I'm Dr. Leif Tapanola from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Hey, today our guest is Chris Anderson. He's the chairman of the Silver Sage Grotto in Twin Falls. We're talking about caves today. Peter, when's the last time you were in a cave?
About 25 years ago.
25 years ago.
When I was down in Oklahoma, we'd go over every summer, we'd go over to Arkansas, and they've got quite a series of limestone caves.
Well, we've got a bunch here. Anywhere in Idaho, you can find some good caves. So we're going to talk about that more with our guest today. But first, I bet you have some nature news.
We've got some nature news, Leif. And today we're going to talk about toxic masculinity.
Toxic masculinity, something neither of us have.
No, none whatsoever.
Not a chance.
No. But okay. It's not going to be in humans. It's in the male funnel web spider.
The male funnel web spider. Okay.
So we have to put the location of where funnel web spiders are found, and they're found in Australia.
Okay.
And we all know that in Australia, just about every top of the category venomous animal critter is found in Australia.
It's so I spent some time in Australia, in Queensland, and everything there bites, and everything there can kill you. I swear, everything.
Everything. And so with the funnel web spider, they their toxin is in a class called the delta hexatoxin.
Okay.
And the delta hexatoxin, what it does is it keeps your nerves turned on. So your nerves are always firing. Fire.
So then it hurts a lot.
It hurts a lot. And in the worst case scenario, if you get bit by a male funnel web spider, you could die in as quickly as 15 minutes.
Wow, that's pretty fast.
Right. And their bite is 6 times more toxic than the female funnel web spider. And the deal is funnel web spiders eat invertebrates. But the male funnel web spider's toxin is, of course, insanely deadly to vertebrates. And we had some researchers down in Queensland trying to figure out why that male funnel web spider's toxin is so deadly when they really do just eat bugs. And what they figured out is over time it's evolved, especially the male, to be deadly to vertebrates. So when they reach maturity, they kind of get kicked out and they have to roam. And as they're moving to find a new territory, they would come across marsupials and other small mammals that would eat them.
Okay.
And of course, the more deadly the venom was to these invertebrates, it favored those male spiders. And so they were able to reproduce. And over time, this venom developed to be extremely toxic.
More toxic than they need to have in order to get the prey.
Yes.
But it's maybe to ward off the animals that might want to eat them.
Them, right. It's to ward off potential predators on them. Just don't get bit by a male funnel web spider.
Well, here in Idaho, we don't have male funnel web spiders.
We do have some venomous critters here, but nothing like them.
It's trivia time. Today we're talking about caves, so, you know, we got to ask, what is the longest lava tube cave in Idaho? Stay tuned, because we're going to talk about caves right after the break.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org, or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome Chris Anderson. He's the chairman of the Silver Sage Grotto in Twin Falls, and he's an avid cave hiker. So thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho. Well, so now you like to spend some time hiking around in caves. Can you tell us how you started doing that sort of thing?
I came by caving in a rather unusual path. I came to caving through astronomy, believe it or not. And if you might be more, how is that possible? Well, as a high school kid, this was Northern Illinois many years ago, I was part of an astronomy club. Once or twice a year, we would go out to this old farmhouse. The farmer would let us sort of, you know, occupy his farmhouse for a weekend. It was way off in the northwest corner of Illinois, where it was relatively dark, away from a lot of the bigger cities. and spend the weekend there enjoying the dark skies with our telescopes. Well, Northern Illinois is not exactly the best weather all the time, and occasionally we'd go out there for a whole weekend and be cloudy the whole time. Well, it turns out there were some cavers in our group, and they said, you know, if we get clouded out all weekend, here's what you need to bring with you if you want to come explore some caves. We know some great caves that are right over the Mississippi River in Iowa. And so as a high school kid, I thought, oh, that sounds kind of cool. I'd like to try that out. And I got hooked. I thought it was a blast, and I've been caving ever since. So that was the late 1970s. So I've been at it for a while.
I like that it was the backup plan. The backup plan was to go caving.
And I do have to clarify for our listeners, because I am from Iowa. When you said Illinois, it is extremely flat. But along the Mississippi, especially on the Iowa side, almost the whole length of the eastern border, there are an extensive number of limestone caves along the Mississippi.
Yeah, and it's mostly because the northeast corner of Iowa is what's called the Driftless Zone. It's basically a place where the last set of glaciers sort of took a detour and missed that part of the state and didn't end up either burying or crushing every cave that was underneath. So that's why.
So now here in Idaho, you're a member of, you're a chairman of the Silver Sage Grotto in Twin Falls, which is a caving group. Is that right?
Right. So it's an official chapter of the National Speleological Society, which is the largest organized group of cavers in the world.
So I assume your group goes out regularly to visit caves in the southern part of the state. Is that true?
We do, yeah. And that's, of course, you know, the vast majority of our caves in southern Idaho are lava caves. Which is, you know, a little different. Most people, when they think caves, they think, you know, limestone with all the beautiful formations and pools and all sorts of things like that. But very different here. We've got a very different sort of caving environment with all the lava tubes here.
So, Chris, before we get into the different types of caves you can find in Idaho, can you tell us a little bit about what the Silver Sage Grotto does?
Yeah, so, you know, primarily we're just a way for cavers to get together and enjoy their hobby. A certain part of that is just the fact that cavers generally have a rule that you don't go underground by yourself, just because, you know, it's a slightly hazardous thing to do. If you were to get hurt or something, you'd be, you know, stuck out there without anyone knowing. So we generally grow in groups of at least three. And so this is a good way for people to get together with other cavers, just to have enough people to go and safely explore caves. But the other thing we like to do is educate, because we know a lot of people probably got introduced to caves in a more casual environment where they may or may not have been explained to them that caves are kind of a rare and valuable natural resource, and they can be quite fragile as well. And so we try to get that educational message across to people, too, that, you know, this is something we want to not only enjoy for ourselves, but preserve for future generations, too.
Let's start with lava tubes, since that is a familiar kind of cave. I think many of our listeners will have been in probably at some point if they're from this part of the state. What is a lava tube? How does it form? What do they look like?
Lava tubes will only form under some very specific set of conditions from an erupting volcano. And, you know, we've all used to seeing pictures of volcanoes with these big, you know, sort of fire fountains coming out of them and glowing lava running down their sides. But it turns out the lava has to have both just the right runniness to it. It can't be too thick. It can't be too runny. And it also has to be flowing on just the right sort of slope. Because if the slope is too steep, then the lava runs off before it has a chance to form a crust on top. And if it's too shallow, then it just solidifies all the way through. It needs to be right at this ideal angle where it will form a crust, and then it will also allow what's inside that's still hotter to drain out and leave a void behind. So there's some fairly specific conditions needed for all those things to happen.
And so the tube is the vacated lava with a crust
exactly
overlying
it,
right?
That's exactly it. And, you know, there's probably many, many lava tubes in our state that have never been discovered simply because there's no opening to the surface. There's a tube underneath the ground, but if it just didn't happen to have a place where the ceiling fell in to reveal that it's there, could lie there for centuries without anyone knowing about it.
And so, okay, so that's one major variety of cave. We'll come back to those. Another that you've mentioned are limestone caves. Where do we find those in the state, and what do they generally look and feel like as different from a lava tube?
Limestone caves are relatively rare in Idaho. Not that limestone is rare in Idaho, but unfortunately, a lot of Idaho's limestone has had a rough go of it. with all the mountain building that's taken place over millions of years, it's done a pretty good job of making it hard for these caves to form. So, you know, you can find limestone in lots of places. You go up around places like Mount Bora, and there's big layers of limestone full of fossils there, but you're not going to find much in the way of caves. So most of our limestone caves are found either like in the southeast corner of the state, and you know, probably some folks listening are familiar with Minnetonka Cave, which is down near Bear Lake, which is a commercial limestone cave, and it's actually quite nice. But there's also some pretty good-sized other wild limestone caves down in southeast Idaho as well. Not super big, but there's some worth checking out. The other place then is up near the Seven Devils above Riggins, and there's some really impressive limestone caves up there. And in fact, there's some that are being actively explored right now. There's a group in Boise that's doing a lot of the exploration up in the Seven Devils area. But the big difference between lava tubes and limestone caves, lava tubes tend to be just that, a tube, a straight shot. Occasionally they'll branch a little bit. They can have a little bit more complexity than that. But limestone is able to form caves in any direction. They can be a three-dimensional maze. The other major difference being that when limestone dissolves and then resolidifies, you get all the beautiful cave formations, the so-called speleothems, which you really don't have much in the way of in lava tubes. Occasionally, you can get water coming into a lava tube that will form those kind of secondary formations, but generally they're not nearly as impressive or extensive as you'd find in a limestone cave.
So we've got a third type of cave that we do have here in Idaho, and it's a tad bit rare. Can you tell us about that cave?
Oh, yeah. This is crazy, and what's crazy to me is how few people are aware of it, because it is such a rare thing. Near Soda Springs, there's a cave called Formation Cave. And this is a case where it's made of what's known as travertine. And people are probably familiar with travertine if they've ever been to West Yellowstone or Mammoth, near Yellowstone. Mammoth Hot Springs that has these giant terraces of travertine where hot springs boil up out of the earth and then leave a mineral coating that slowly builds up these levels of terraces and dams. The one near Soda Springs is not nearly as vertical as all that, but it did manage to not just form these pools, but actually form roofs on them eventually, such that there's actually a true cave. You can go in and be in the dark. And that's a caver's definition of what a cave is. It's a naturally occurring void where it's possible to get completely away from any outside light coming in. Formation Cave is one of only two known like it in the world. The other one's in Egypt, of all places. And the one in Egypt was only found from an alabaster mine where they had dug deep down in the ground and broke into this giant version of a Formation Cave underground. The one in Egypt is huge compared to the one in Idaho, though. So there's only two. We've got the small one here in Idaho.
But we've got right.
Well, we've got one for sure, and it's absolutely worth a visit. It's really a surreal kind of place because when you first get there, and it's run by the Nature Conservancy, so they're protecting it. You first get there, and it looks a lot like Mammoth Hot Springs, where you see all these, you know, kind of travertine terraces, but they're all dry. The water table dropped a long time ago and left them all kind of high and dry. And then now you can, like, literally go in and kind of crawl around and explore within these travertine, the naturally occurring, the travertine pools now dry.
Okay, so now we've got our three different types of caves that we can find in Idaho. I'm going to plan a day where I do want to explore some of these caves. And we kind of talked a little bit with the Silver Sage Grotto, and we already know that we need to have a partner, two or three people coming with us for safety. What other kind of safety precautions or things that we need to think about before we enter a cave?
Well, one of the most important things I tell people if they're going to explore a cave is have some sort of head protection. People think, oh, you know, I'll just watch my head. And that's easier said than done because we don't have eyes on top of our heads. And, you know, a lot of the time you can be walking along and you're just not aware of how low that ceiling is. And boy, it only takes one or two bumps on the ceiling when you're going to wish you had some kind of protection. And, you know, you can go down to the hardware store and get these plastic bump caps, like a construction type cap, for cheap. You know, they're less than $10. And that's cheap insurance right there. You'll be glad the first time you were wearing one of those and bumped your head in a cave. Without those, you'd be a very unhappy guy, especially with lava, because lava is hard and sharp in places. It can really gouge you badly. So that's the one thing I would say. Second thing I would say is make sure you've got adequate light. A lot of people just say, oh, grab that flashlight, we'll all go together and go underground. It's like, that's great until that one flashlight fails. So we cavers generally say the rule is 3 independent sources of light per person to be really, really safe.
I think most people have like little LED headlamps when they go camping or something like that.
Sure, yeah, those are great. In fact, LEDs have really made kind of a revolution in caving. You know, in the old days, we would have lights powered by, you know, with incandescent bulbs and regular batteries, and even going further back, carbide lamps, like old miner-style lamps. I still own one of those. I don't use it very much anymore. But LEDs, you know, you can get so much more life out of the batteries. They're a lot brighter than incandescent bulbs. They're more robust. You can bang them against a rock, and they're more likely to survive as opposed to a bulb that has a filament in it with one good jar, and it can be done. So LEDs have been great for caving.
You mean you don't miss the D battery flashlights that
I do not miss the D battery flashlights.
A tenth of the light, but it, you know, 5 times the size and 3 pounds.
Well, I've always noticed going into caves, even in the, you know, the hottest months of summer, and it's cold in there. Like it's a totally different climate.
Yeah, that's another great thing about caving is that the climate stays pretty much the same year round. So, you know, if it's 100 degrees out, it could be 55 degrees underground. If it's 10 degrees below zero out, it could be 55 degrees underground. And that makes it for a great all year round sport.
What about footwear? What do you wear on your feet down there?
In Idaho, it's not nearly as restrictive as it might be in other places. You know, if you're going into a limestone cave where there's a lot of wet and slippery surfaces, you definitely want something with more of a gripping sole. But, you know, most of Idaho's caves are dry. So really any kind of comfortable, reasonably, you know, grippy footwear, even tennis shoes are good, just because you don't really have to worry too much about water. I can't say that that's always the case. There are some wet caves in Idaho. Just most of the lava tubes are pretty dry, though. So, you know, really just any kind of relatively sturdy footwear that you don't mind getting kind of muddy.
So we're kind of looking at a decent pair of hiking shoes, hiking boots.
Yeah, day hikers are great, that kind of thing for sure.
I presume many of these caves that you would travel to have some kind of a map or guidebook that would allow you to, you know, have a sense of what you're getting into before you get into it.
Actually, just the opposite. The vast majority of caves in Idaho are probably unmapped. Now, there is a group in eastern Idaho called the Idaho Cave Survey. So unlike a grotto, which is strictly a group that is interested primarily in exploration, their whole thrust is just that, mapping caves. The thing is, they're not necessarily going to be super forthcoming with anyone who just walks in the door and says, hi, can I see your maps? And that's really because cavers tend to be a little on the secretive side when it comes to protecting the caves. The rule we have is that we would rather anger you by not telling you where our caves are than possibly give out information to somebody who's not going to treat them with respect and end up with a cave that's permanently trashed. Because the problem is, lava tubes, once they're damaged, can never recover. Right? That's the type of rock that is never going to be able to heal itself. You think of limestone caves that, you know, drip these formations and grow over time. And of course, I would never tell anyone to ever break one of those. But if it were accidentally to get broken, there's a chance that it could grow back over time. Not going to happen in a lava tube. A lava tube is, or the lava that was there when it was formed, and that's it. So, we have to be really super careful. And so cavers can come off as a little standoffish at times. We've had people show up at some of our grotto meetings and say, hey, can we get a list of where all your caves are? And we politely tell them no, and they feel like they're being treated badly. It's like, no, we actually don't even pass around lists within our own group just because we don't want to make sure they're not going to accidentally fall into the wrong hands and end up with somebody who might want to treat it as a place to have a party or light off fireworks or spray paint the walls. So we definitely try really hard to protect our cave resources.
So let's talk a little bit about cave etiquette. And when you do go in there, and, you know, we've got the extremes of parties and bonfires and spray painting and all that lovely damage. If we're going to look at serious cavers, what is the etiquette that you want to bring in with you as you're caving?
Well, you know, above all, it's leave no trace, right? We want to make sure that if someone else visits the cave right after we did, it would be really hard for them to tell that we were there. So we leave nothing behind. If you got to use the bathroom, you do it before you go underground. If you're going to have a snack, be sure you're not going to be dropping crumbs anywhere. You want to try never to touch any sort of formation, because formations can be inhibited by the presence of oil from your skin. We want to make sure to be careful of any creatures that live in the cave. And the first one that comes to mind for most people are bats. And bats are a pretty fragile animals, and they hibernate during the winter months. Well, bats, unlike bears, are true hibernators. They really do shut their bodies down to a very low level of metabolism. Bears can actually wake up in the middle of the winter and go out and go poop in the woods or whatever, come back and start sleeping again. Bats don't have that luxury. Whatever food supply they got to start their hibernation at the beginning of the winter has to last them through the entire winter. So if they're woken up or disturbed in the middle of the winter, that's a death sentence for them. So, you know, we definitely want to be sure that we're mindful of not going into caves where there are known bats hibernating during the winter months. We also have to be a little cognizant of the fact that there are caves where bats have their young, what are called maternity colonies, and those are vulnerable during the opposite times of the year, during the warm weather months. So we generally keep lists of which caves are known to be hibernacula and which ones are known to be maternity colonies, and avoid those at the appropriate times of the year.
I do have to say thank you for distinguishing between hibernation in bats and, say, a torpor in bears, because they don't hibernate. And I love the term hibernaculum, so thank you for those two bits of this discussion.
Well, and that also kind of brings up another issue, which is this disease called white nose syndrome. And white nose is something that showed up in the U.S. a number of years ago in New York. It's been working its way across the country. And it's utterly harmless to humans, but it's been utterly devastating to bat populations. And basically what it is a fungus that doesn't kill the bat directly, but it does interrupt their hibernation cycle. And therefore, they wake up in the middle of the winter because of the fungus. There's no food to be had, and they starve to death before springtime comes. Luckily for us, white nose has not gotten to Idaho yet, but we know it's probably a matter of time before it gets here. It was very discouraging to Idaho cavers when a few years ago it showed up in Washington State. And prior to that, it hadn't been anywhere within two or three states of Idaho. And so it just kind of appeared in Washington State. So now we figure it's kind of knocking on our doorstep, and probably it's just a matter of time before it gets here now.
So to kind of clarify on the white nose syndrome, it has a 98% mortality rate within hibernaculums. And as a fungus, they got the white nose name because it's a white fungus. And you do see it growing around the nose and on the wings of the bat. And what it does is it disturbs their hibernation. It irritates them. They wake up. And the moment they wake up, they want to eat. And if they wake up in January or February, there's no insects for them to eat.
Right. And that's an important point, is that Idaho's bats, without exception, are insectivores. So they're not going to latch on your neck for your blood. they don't eat frogs and things like that, where you see them in bats in other places might. They are all insectivores. And, you know, to me, I know a lot of people that are kind of creeped out by bats, you know, especially it's October, it's Halloween and all that. But bats are actually very beneficial and actually kind of adorable. If you get to see them up close, they're cute, fuzzy little critters, but they're also very beneficial because they eat night-flying insects. Well, what kind of insects fly at night? Two of my least favorite in the world, moths and mosquitoes. So unless you're a fan of moths and mosquitoes, you know, you should be a big fan of bats.
We should love our bats. And we learned on a previous show, actually, with a bat expert, that bats purr just like kittens do.
See, now I didn't even know that.
Well, there you go. See, cool. More reasons to love your bats. You know, I imagine being in a cave, one of the absolutely wonderful things about being there is it's almost a foreign ecosystem. It must be really quiet in there, and it must feel very different. Could you tell us what's a perfect day for you hiking in a cave?
Well, one of the things that I really get a big kick out of is if I ever find a way to get into a part of a cave that I can be fairly sure that no human being has ever been in before. And that's a pretty rare experience because, you know, a lot of our caves have been explored very, very thoroughly. So unless you are in a cave that is, you know, relatively recently discovered, or if you happen to find a way into a passage that maybe, you know, by moving a rock or something that clearly has never been moved, that's a pretty rare thing. But just knowing that, you know, that you have now occupied a space that no human has ever been in before, it kind of gives you a little chill. It's like, wow, this is a truly unique thing. But, you know, to get to your original point, too, one of the things I really love about caving is that unlike almost any other outdoor sport you might be able to think of, within minutes, you can be completely isolated from the developed world of man, right? I can go hike a mountain and still see contrails going overhead or hear a jet, you know, going over my head. I can look down into the valley and see where all the agricultural impacts of man are. But with a cave, 5 minutes from the entrance, I can be in a true wilderness that appears untouched and unaffected by the developments of humans, both from a sound standpoint and from a light standpoint. You turn your lights off, and that is the darkest dark you will ever experience, bar none. So, those are just unique experiences that caving offers that almost no other sport I can think of does.
When I was in Arkansas, we went through a cave. It's called the Bat Cave, and there's a section called the Birth Canal. And I'm a relatively skinny dude, and to crawl through it, you had to turn your head sideways because there wasn't enough room. And you're sitting there, and like you said, you've got one light, and it's just such a narrow spot, and you've got tons and tons of rock above you, and you're going, if I get stuck, what happens now?
You know, and I think every caver will tell you that at some point in their caving, they've had that brief, sometimes not so brief, flash of claustrophobia. So, you know, claustrophobia is something that everybody experiences. It's just a matter of to what degree. You know, I know people that couldn't even go into a giant passage, and I know other people who can squeeze themselves between, you know, tiny little spaces. But, at some point you can always stuff yourself into a hole small enough to make you feel claustrophobic, for sure.
As you're speaking of these caves, you know, these are non-renewable resources. These are places that can lose the quality that we love about them so easily if we don't treat them properly. What's the balance between encouraging folks to go out there and visit caves and to enjoy nature and enjoy these unique ecosystems that exist there and the unique experience that someone can have in that space, but at the same time, balancing that with not over inundating those resources with too many people and some of the downsides that can come with that?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question, because I think that points to one of the best resources that people have if they want to start exploring caves is to seek out their local cavers, organized cavers, which is, you know, typically a chapter of the National Speleological Society. And the reason I say that is because they're going to be familiar with which cave resources in the area are the most and least vulnerable. And, you know, so we're going to start anyone off who's a beginning caver with caves that have been pretty well traveled, you know, that have seen their share of human impact. And then as their caving skills develop, we feel more comfortable taking them to the ones that are more fragile. I know of a cave in southern Idaho, the beautiful cave. It's got some of the most amazing lava formations you'll ever see, including ones called, you'll love this term, stalagpies. You guys have heard of stalactites and stalagmites, right? Well, a stalagpie is where the lava has been extruded up from the floor. So there was a crust of hard lava on the floor with liquid lava underneath. And as that crust got heavier and squozed down on the liquid lava below, it would squirt up through cracks and form these sort of bottom-up, almost looks like dribbled candle wax, but they form from the floor upward.
That's cool.
And, they're truly amazing in this particular cave, but there's also parts of this cave where literally you take like several seconds for every footstep, because there's so many little fragile things on the ground that if you were to just step a little bit off the sort of main well-beaten path, you'd be doing permanent damage to some of these formations. So you're literally just walking through like step, take a breath, step, take a breath, step, take a breath. And that's definitely not something you want to bring a beginner to. You want to make sure that they've developed their, not only their cave skills, but their sense of stewardship of the caves before you to bring them to a place like that. So that's why I think one of the biggest, best functions of organized cavers is knowing which are the valuable and rare and delicate resources and being able to guide people appropriately to them.
Thank you, Chris. You know, we started our show off with a trivia question about what the longest lava tube cave in Idaho is. Could you help us with that?
You bet. And I can speak from experience because I helped map this cave. It's called Gypsum Cave. It's in Lincoln County, Idaho. Not an easy one to find, but it has almost 2.5 miles of interconnected lava tube passage, including places where there are 6 different levels of lava tube where lava flowed through the cave and formed its own mini tubes within the cave.
That is a good hike for a day, you know? Awesome. We want to thank Chris Anderson for joining us today. And to learn more about caving in your area, please visit caves.org.
The Nature of Idaho is produced at KISU-FM Studios at Idaho State University in Pocatello. Technical assistance and production by Jamin Anderson and Caitlin Hart. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of this and all past episodes of The Nature of Idaho can be found at KISU.org. Find The Nature of Idaho weekly podcast on iTunes or Google Play Music. For more information, click on the Idaho logo at KISU.org or send email to noidkisu@isu.edu.